Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes. It is September 4th, 2010, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. My background is in psychology. I'm a PhD clinical and forensic psychologist, and I've studied widely in the mystical, spiritual, and occult areas for 30 years plus. And I have a series of books which I've written on my explorations. And the most important of those is something called The Heart Doctrine. And the basic concept of this book is that human consciousness originates out of the heart in the human being. Consciousness is not created by material neurological processes in the brain. That instead there's an actual physics and higher dimensional metaphysics to the human heart. And that human beings are ensouled through the heart. And not only through the heart, but the generation of the heartbeat and then the oxygenation of the blood through the breath. And that is how a human being is ensouled, through the heart and through the bloodstream. And I realized early on in my studies of Western psychology that everybody simply assumed what I would call the head doctrine, the belief or assumption that the brain produces consciousness and it is centered in the head. And as I studied esoteric spiritual teachings over many years, I realized that they were providing an alternative viewpoint that a human being's true self is within the heart. In Judaism, they sometimes say the truth is under our noses all the time, and that would be within the heart. And you look at all the different mystical literature, from native spirituality to the Vedas and yogic teachings and Blavatsky and mystical Christianity and Kabbalah and other sources, you find what I would call the heart doctrine, that a human being in some sense does have a true I, a singular I, that the I and the sense of self is not something produced by the brain in the head, but instead it originates out of the heart. And that's called the heart doctrine. So it's an alternative view of this profound enigma in modern science, is what is the origin and nature of human consciousness. And I'm arguing the heart doctrine and critiquing the head doctrine. Also attempting to explain ideas about the psychology of the soul. Now the second, the Heart Doctrine book is available through Amazon.com, anywhere throughout North America, or it can be ordered directly from my website at www.zeropoint.ca. Now the second book, which I'm hope to have available in a new, very attractive trade paperback edition, is called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And what this is an attempt to do is look at the secret doctrine, which is this very difficult and abstruse manuscript published in 1888 by H.P. Blavatsky, Helena Blavatsky. And it has been described by Manly Hall as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. So it's this very influential and seminal early book in Western occultism. And Blavatsky was highly regarded by everyone from the Masons to Crowley, and she founded her own theosophical societies and has become very famous over the past century. But her book, The Secret Doctrine, is that what is taught in there has hardly been touched upon by any contemporary writers or investigators. So my newest work on volume one of The Secret Doctrine, which is called Cosmogenesis. And what I attempt to do is explain Blavatsky's views and compare those to the newest ideas in modern physics and cosmology. And it has as a background, I'm trying to look at the issue of the existence of God and what is meant by the term God. So so that's kind of an underscore. I attempt in the book essentially to outline a model of intelligent design based upon understanding zero points and an alternate model of the nature of space. So it's a model of intelligent design. This is explained by Blavatsky. She says that the material points without extension, or like little zero points, are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. It's a very bizarre statement, but the idea is that all living beings have a zero-point center. And it is through this zero-point center that the spiritual and divine intelligences on higher dimensional planes of being, it is the means by which they bring life and consciousness into a human being. That we are ensouled through a higher dimensional metaphysics, and this is centered on the heart. So this, I hope this book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, I've worked at this for about 3 years now, even though I began to study the Secret Doctrine over 30 years ago. But the issues of this book are still very contemporary, and it's a very alternative interpretation even of the Secret Doctrine. Because in ways I would be critical of theosophists who I would argue have not given enough attention to Blavatsky's, her teaching about zero points or what she calls Leia centers. But anyway, at the moment, on this show, with my co-host who I'll bring on in a moment, Jim and I have been talking about the Secret Doctrine and the issues of science and religion. And over the next few shows, we're going to continue to go through some of the material of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, explaining both what Blavatsky taught in 1888 and then how that is confirmed, or how scientists have arrived at similar ideas in our time. Blavatsky predicted in 1888, she said, the rejection of these teachings must be expected in our day, but only in our day, for in the next century, people would realize that the teachings of the Secret Doctrine had neither been invented nor exaggerated. So Blavatsky in 1888 predicted that future science would confirm what she was saying in the Secret Doctrine. So we're going to be exploring that over the next shows, and as well as the issues of God and science. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Chris.
This is Jim Moffat. I, Christopher, live in just south of Ottawa, Ontario, and Jim's in Toronto. How are you, Jim? I thank you for your email about your writings on Stephen Hawking's new book.
Yeah, I saw this thing on the internet on Thursday night, I guess, and it said it was one of those little blurbs on one of the sites like Yahoo or something, and it said Hawking's something to the effect that Hawking says that there is no God, and then I went to the little write-up about it, and basically what it said was that Hawking in his new book, Stephen Hawking, in his new book, says that physicists' understanding of the law of gravity is bringing them closer and closer to a view where there's basically the idea is that there's no need to have a God because of the advances in physics recently. And you know, I had a variety of reactions to it. I mean, he essentially has said this. You pointed this out in your work before discussing him. He's talked about how
Oh, welcome back. We've just had some interference here. BBS has been having some computer interference and hacking in their website and disruption of phone calls and problems along this line. And we just have to see our way through it and not be distracted. Hi, Jim, you're back on?
Yeah, I'm back.
I'm not sure when we lost. Welcome. We're back. We have had some ongoing interruptions here today, but this is Christopher Holmes and James. Jim, you there?
Yep.
Yeah. Welcome back.
Yeah.
Okay.
To pick up, let me just go back. I restate a little
bit.
Really, what I was reacting to a little bit is that there was this item on the internet about Stephen Hawking says that there's no God, and then I read the article and I find out that he has a new book coming out, and he says that the advances in physics in terms of their understanding, physicists' understanding of gravity and the striving for the unification of the laws of physics is doing away with the need to posit the existence of God, and really this is, if you know Hawking's work at all, this is old hat for him. It's really what he's basically stating is the so-called, what's called the quote, God of the gaps, unquote, argument, which is that as science progresses and we provide naturalistic explanations and theories based on observation and experimentation of the externally visible world, we have less and less need to bring God into our explanatory accounts of anything in the universe. And this is a very old argument, and essentially is what Carl Sagan put forth in his book, Broke His Brain, in the 1970s, in a lecture entitled A Sunday Sermon. And at the time, Christopher read that piece, and in that piece, Sagan says, it seems that as science advances, there is less and less for God to do, and Christopher dubbed this the problem of God's contracting universe. Is it, in fact, true that as science advances, there's less and less need to believe in God, and less reason to believe in God is what essentially that materialist scientists are arguing. So when I wrote this little piece that I sent out to people, I just pointed out that really the problem with people like Sagan, Daniel Dennett, Stephen Hawking, Stephen Weinberg, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, the so-called radical atheists or scientific atheists that are very popular now and are very prominent. Their works are all over the place. And you know, there's been as many replies to their work, too. I mean, there's a full-fledged debate going on about this. But the problem with what they argue, it's not what they argue. It's that they invoke the authority of science to buttress their arguments that God doesn't exist. And there's a huge problem in the sense that science doesn't investigate the existence of God. There are no scientific experiments that are aimed at detecting or proving or disproving the existence of God. These are extrapolations based on primarily the study of physics and chemistry, which deal with material processes, and they're making pronouncements based on these sciences about the nature of spirit and soul and higher spiritual realities and the existence of God, and they're certainly entitled to their opinions on these things. And what I kind of object to mostly about somebody like Hawking is that he I think what he would argue is that, look, there's never been any time in the history of humankind where people have had such sophisticated knowledge about the nature of reality. This is essentially what Carl Sagan was arguing 35 years ago, what Steven Weinberg has been arguing for many years, what Sam Harris is arguing in the...
Welcome back. This is Christopher and James Moffat, and we're resuming our show again. We've been disrupted today quite a bit. I hope we'll be able to see the show through to the end of the next the end of this hour. Welcome back, Jim. has been disrupted. Okay.
Yeah.
And then when I've lost you twice. Like, you seemed to have disappeared first, and I kept on talking, and I didn't know if I was on air or not. Eh?
Oh.
So then we've got a few loose threads here. But so let me just pick it up a little bit for a moment. I introduced the show and was saying a little bit about the book, The Heart Doctrine, and then I was going to start talking about the science of the secret doctrine of Blavatsky and this book, and it raises this issue, issues of God and science, because based on the secret doctrine, there's a whole alternative model of intelligent design. And there's many things in the secret doctrine of Blavatsky which anticipated all the new ideas in physics and cosmology, including a whole bunch of things like vacuum genesis, creation from a singularity, expanding, contracting space times, the seven-dimensional hyperspace, the enigmas of the uncertainty principle, non-local effects, as well as many other features, multiple universes,
holographic
principles. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, and so all these ideas were in Blavatsky in 1888. And then now scientists, and we started talking about Stephen Hawking, who we're going to come to in a minute, now scientists in the modern times are kind of saying, well, as science has advanced, there's less and less for God to do. But part of our point here is that how these scientists who make these types of pronouncements, Jim was saying they don't do it on a scientific basis. Like, it's their personal prejudices and feelings and viewpoints, and they're, of course, entitled to those. But they present it as though this is kind of demonstrated by science. Now, there are many kinds of problems with this, all kinds of problems, but most importantly from my vantage point is that they never seriously consider what the mystics have said about creation processes. That they don't really go into Kabbalistic teachings, which has creation out of nothingness of the Ein, the Ein Sof, and the Ein Sof Hour, which is the quantum vacuum, which is void and plenum. Kabbalists talked about that. Kabbalists talk about the universe originating from a point source. They've done it for hundreds of years. It was only around the turn of this century, the 1990s, that scientists began to trace the universe back to a singularity origin. So many of these ideas of modern science, vacuum genesis, creation from a singularity, seven-dimensional hyperspace, a lot of these ideas are actually, they confirm the similar concepts in the mystical teachings. So, I mean, this is just one basis upon which it's so fraudulent to have these kind of declarations that modern physics proves that God doesn't exist, because they don't really give mystical ideas any fair hearing. It's not a rational scientific debate. It's more, and they have a basic kind of ignorance of what these subjects entail. Okay, so I'll turn it, Jim, you can kind of pick up from there.
I was arguing that, you know, you wouldn't find many people who would accuse Stephen Hawking of being an ignoramus about anything, but I think that the whole the viewpoint that science has arrived at this the most objective and sophisticated understanding of the nature of reality and of the universe is really it's just simply not true, because I would in keeping with the spirit of Madame Blavatsky, I would lay the ancient esoteric and mystical doctrine side by side with modern science and compare these and these two different accounts of the nature of things. And I think that when you do that, when you begin to study things, it becomes very obvious that that's the thrust of your entire of all of your work, is that when you do that, there are these startling similarities. And in some sense, I think there's that the mystical and esoteric teachings are more comprehensive, and I think that what at the very least they do is they throw light on the assumptive framework that underlies all of modern materialist reductionist science. But even, like, as I said, you can argue against the position that Hawking and Dennett and Sagan, they're all materialists, and they're all materialists and reductionists in a very significant ways. I think you can argue against them based simply on science. I don't think you have to believe in God. I think that if you look at the history, this is what astonishes me. If you look at the history of 20th century physics, you have repeatedly pronouncements from people like Sir James Jeans and Arthur Eddington and various Heisenberg and Bohr, the greatest luminaries in the history of 20th century physics, saying that the James Jeans says, you know, the consensus of opinion and amongst physicists is that we're heading towards a view of a non-mechanical reality, that the universe, rather than being a great machine, begins more and more to look like a great thought. Or you have Eddington saying that physics reveals a shadow world of symbols behind which is another reality which science cannot penetrate, but which perhaps mysticism can provide us with insight into. I mean, there are all sorts of explanations. I mean, Eddington says that the stuff of the universe is mind stuff. And within all of the sciences, there are all sorts of there are all sorts of dissenters to the prevailing materialist perspective. The beauty of the materialist perspective is it's so good in explaining things on certain levels, and it's so good at predicting things that it looks like it's a comprehensive explanation, but it isn't. I mean, you can make a really good, you know, computer because you're a materialist, or you can produce a hell of a dishwasher, but that doesn't mean that you understand the nature of the soul and spirit and God. I mean, those are huge steps. Really, the materialist position can't account for life or consciousness, which is sort of important. And so that was essentially the thrust. I quoted the conversation that Jonathan Cott had with Rabbi Lawrence Kushner in about 1985 when he interviewed him. And Cott said, you know, cosmologists have now come to this idea that everything emerged out of this, the universe emerged out of this single point. And Rabbi Kushner says, well, in the 14th century, you know, Kabbalists were describing precisely the same thing. And it really, I think it goes back even further than that. I mean, in the history of esoteric thought, I don't know, Chris, if you know of other instances where people have talked about point source singularities. I have a feeling that this is a very, very ancient idea in Buddhism and in Kabbalah and perhaps in the Vedas. Do you know if there are other?
Yeah, I understand in the Vedas they're called bindi points.
Okay.
It's something I've wanted to actually to study more, like to see how the zero point concept is in the Vedic teachings. It's almost, I'd need to read more widely.
Certainly, in terms of the heart doctrine, though, we see this throughout all of the, as you pointed out in your book. I mean, you see this through all of these different esoteric and mystical teachings throughout all parts of the world and all different ages and all different systems of metaphysical teachings. You see this recurring description of this, like these God sparks or these these infinitesimally small points within the heart, which are rooted into these higher dimensions and which produce life and consciousness. And I mean, so on the individual human being level, these ideas are very, very old. And
yeah.
Given that, I mean, it's implicit that really this is not only psychological but cosmological within various teachings. Like in the Upanishads, when it's talking, really when you say that the universe within a human being is as vast as the universe without, essentially you're saying that there's some sort of holographic principle implied there. So it has a cosmological significance at the same time. So again, just to return to Hawking, as like, you know, he's a brilliant physicist, but he doesn't know dick about mysticism or esotericism, and neither do any of these other guys. As I said on the last program, what's astounding to me is I've never read one intelligent discussion of mystical and esoteric teachings and what they say in which somebody is critical of them. I've seen all sorts of pejorative references to mysticism, all sorts of denial that anything in modern science could possibly be related to mystical or esoteric teachings, how people overreach and try to draw these parallels. But I've never seen one substantive discussion because you can't do it. I mean, I if somebody did it, I'd be very interested in what they have to say. But you don't see it because nobody studies it. And the people who do study mystical and esoteric teachings who have scientific backgrounds come around to saying, holy mackerel, you know, there's something very profound here. And that's what's so maddening about all this is it's like this, it's incomprehensible in a way. It's like this bizarre gap in people's educations that you know, for all our smarts in modern times, people are incredibly ignorant. Even educated and intelligent people are incredibly ignorant about all of this. So at the very least, you know, we're performing a public service in trying to bring people's attention to this. It's an uphill climb, though.
Yeah, it's funny. If I had to look in a way like this issue of the problem of God's contracting universe or the idea of God of the gaps, like, what are the two major gaps in modern science? One gap, I would say, or an unresolved enigma or mystery in modern science, is that of human consciousness. And that's generally widely recognized throughout psychology and other disciplines, the enigmas of human consciousness. So that's one gap that the scientists haven't yet been able to fill in, but which they promise to.
Yeah.
They offer us promissory science. Like Searles, one investigator, says, we don't know how yet the brain produces consciousness, but we know that it does, and it's just a matter of time to figure it out how it does it. So it's kind of promissory science. And the other major, major gap is like where we trace the universe back to the first instance of creation. And that's what Stephen Hawking focuses on, the idea of the singularity. And I was explaining when you were off air at one point how, like, the singularity is predicted by the general theory of relativity, which allows kind of infinite space-time collapse to a point, but that it's inconsistent with the uncertainty principle in modern quantum physics, because something can only be narrowed to a certain point at which it passes beyond our perception. That point is that down at the Planckian levels. So Hawking wanted to avoid the Big Bang singularity because he said, quote, it smacks of divine intervention, which it certainly does. It certainly does. It's this, like, first point. And he says it smacks of divine intervention. So what he wants to do is then smear that point out into the whole. Just smear the point out into the hole, and then that kind of gets rid of the singularity. which is so absurd, because I mean, the very fact that you have the universe collapsing down to a point, even at Planckian levels, like even at that point, if it gets smeared out into the infinite, which is what mystical teachings suggest anyway, because they say suggest any point ultimately is rooted into the infinite. So as you penetrate to the innermost nature of any point, then it leads into the infinite. So even how he wants to smear the point out into the infinite, that's consistent also with mystical teachings.
Well,
you know,
even all of that too is that, you know, the third gap is that I don't think that modern materialist science can explain life. The Miller-Urey experiment, you know, is an interesting experiment, but I don't think it explains life. I mean, you can put a physical chemical mixture together and spark it and produce amino acids and proteins, but really you can't account for life. And you certainly on a human level, I've mentioned this many times, but it seems to me that this is like this huge enigma within biology is how when all of the actual physical constituents of our physical bodies are breaking down and being replaced all the time, how is it that the material that replaces it not only assumes the proper form and creates aggregates with other molecules to form the cells and the physical constituents of our body, but preserves the memory of what's happened. It seems to me like everything in biology in a materialist position, there's something essential missing there, which is the intelligence which guides all this and which informs it. Because really, we don't exist throughout our lifetimes as continuous physical assemblies. You know, we do, but we're not. There's an inherent dynamism going on in our lifetime, and there's this miracle that's going on all the time within our physical beings, and nobody can really explain that in biology. I mean, in biology, the whole problem of morphology in terms of how do cells know which cells to become and how to become certain parts of the body and to fulfill certain functions. Everybody knows that that's one of the great unanswered questions. But even it's just like the ongoing continuity of the physical body, to me, points to like some sort of fields or some sort of something is behind the physical manifestation and informing an intelligence that's guiding it. And even more so is somehow programmed in terms of life, but also remembers, you know, so that if you have a scar, mm-hmm. you know, even though all those cells have died, that your scar remains. Like, how is that possible?
I mean,
there's so many enigmas. I mean, we know so much in terms of modern biology and science, but I think that is like everything else. I think the materialist position is very good within certain parameters, but eventually it encounters all these enigmas and anomalies because it's not a comprehensive explanation. And like Karl Popper, the most eminent philosopher of science of the 20th century, called it promissory materialism, which is a position that eventually, just give us time, we'll get around to explaining all this. But they won't. I mean, that's what's so maddening about all this is that really, as I was saying earlier, if you look at the history of 20th century science, really, it's undermined the materialist position. It's shown the limitations of the materialist position and really points to the need to recognize something akin to spirit, which informs everything, some higher degree.
Yeah, some spirit or intelligence.
Intelligence. There's something.
Yeah, which kind of underlies and informs material energetic processes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you see in that consistent
with a mystical and esoteric perspective, which is exactly what they say, that there are these mm-hmm. forces, these higher intelligences, which are informing all levels of creation, and you know, I mean, in the zero point teaching, you're actually providing a dynamic which applies on both an individual and a cosmological level, and I mean, again, which is consistent with the whole idea within esotericism, as above, so below. Man is made in the image of God. You know, like what's the other one? The man is
microcosm, macrocosm.
Of the macrocosm. These are profound ideas expressed in these little verbal formulas, which if you really understood them, I mean, as you explore esotericism and mysticism, you come to a very different understanding of these things. The more you understand, the more you realize, oh my God, what a profound thing that really is. It's easy to shuck it off and say, oh, that's drivel, if you don't understand what it refers to, because on a superficial level, it seems silly and it seems, you know, completely illogical. What do you mean, as above, so below? Man's a microcosm, a macrocosm. How could that be? You know, or you can make fun of it, like Gurdjieff says, like, man is made in God's image, but that doesn't mean it's because man carries his comb in his front pocket like God
or his
does,
back
you know?
Pocket, yeah, God with his comb in his pocket.
I mean, but it's so perfect, because that's sort of the level of most, I would say, most of these scientific atheists, that's their level of discussion of what it means to be religious is, or to believe in God. It's like,
yeah,
they create these straw men and these caricatures, and certainly there are people who believe these things. I mean, they're also analysts in various religions that do put forth, like, very, what I would say, very silly interpretations of scripture or of limited understanding of what's being said, but that's not exhaustive of what all these meanings are. And as I said,
yeah, they debunk a straw man, like create this caricature of what religion is saying, like as though you're going to have God sitting, like God sits on
it's
something
on
that's
throne,
not God on the throne. I mean, you might have beings that do, you know, have thrones and such in varied ways, but we imagine God as this bearded patriarch. You know, these concepts, that's what they debunk, like these big debunkers.
Yeah.
You know, they debunk the fundamentalist Christian idea that you know, Genesis occurred 6,000 years ago.
And
that's all just based on some bishop from the
bishop
1700s
Usher.
Or something.
Bishop Usher in the 17th century or the 18th century. Yeah, I mean.
And that was based on his looking at the derivations of the family trees and lines and such.
Yeah.
But all of it is symbolic, and Genesis itself. Well, and I don't want to go off, but I just want to come back, like, so we're talking about the God of the gaps, and we, in a way, I was saying the first real gap is the whole thing of human consciousness, a complete mystery in modern science. Second thing is this whole thing of creation physics, and how the mystical accounts of creation have anticipated all the newest scientific ideas. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. The scientists are confirming what mystics have claimed for hundreds and thousands of years. And then the third area that you brought up is this whole issue of what is life. And scientists assume that life somehow comes from matter, comes from below, that matter organizes itself in a certain way and it gives birth to life. Whereas from a mystical point of view, life, in a way, comes from above. It's kind of out of higher dimensions. And so there's a spiritual entity within the human body. And the body is a vehicle for that inner entity, that spiritual self. But the body is not what we are. It's a vehicle. It's like a clothing or a glove. Okay, but there's something higher dimensional within the human being. But this whole issue of what is life and how what does life come from, and that's completely unresolved, as you say, in modern biology. And they can't, life comes from life. I remember Prabhupada saying that. Life always comes from life. And I don't think scientists have never produced life. And I think of that one example of, that's so interesting from my perspective, is how they tried to culture heart cell cells and tissues in the lab, and they were unable to do it. The heart cells wouldn't differentiate. But then they began to zap it with electricity in the way that a pacemaker in the heart might, and then these cells began to differentiate. So then they would assume, that proves it can be done by material causes.
Yeah.
But kind of from our perspective, well, that's exactly what mystical teachings are saying. There's something that functions as that electrodynamic zapping. There's something metaphysical that has that function that help leads to the differentiation of the heart cells, you know, which, according to the Dalai Lama, is the first place from which a human being begins to grow and evolve is the heart. He describes that in the fetus, and you look at the youngest fetus and you see the heart is defined first, you know, and that it's, the neurological development is much later. So it's like the being grows from the heart in a way. That's in Tibetan Buddhism, that the indestructible drop there is the basis of the whole living system. So that's like a third area of enigmas, completely unresolved by modern science. And I was thinking, we should write a book called The Gaps, or something like that, where we kind of pointed out all of these essential things, what science doesn't know, you know?
Which goes again to Uspensky's quote about, you know, if you took all the system-destroying facts, he was writing almost 100 years ago within science, and you added them up, it's like, then it really does destroy it. And then he says, you know, science has to come to mysticism because in it, there's a new method and a new way of knowing and organizing things. And I think that's what I mean. That's what we believe, and that's what we see. And again, you know, if someone was to actually study esoteric and mystical teachings and have a critical analysis of what's wrong with them and to be able to argue cogently against them, I'd be very interested in reading. I just don't think any such thing exists. I know, like, for instance, in Madame Blavatsky's Baboon by Peter Washington, he talks about these figures who brought the spirituality and mysticism to the West at the turn of the 20th century, and he talks about Blavatsky and Gurdjieff and Rudolf Steiner and Krishnamurti. But, you know, it's so interesting in his book. It's an interesting book because there's a lot of good stories in it, and it's real well written and everything. But it's really an ad hominem attack on all of these people. There's no substantive discussion of any of their ideas, and that's, I mean, he's a little bit better because at least he knows a little bit about them and he can point to certain things. But I mean, it's such a phony book in the sense that you can't talk about any of these people without talking about their teachings, because they don't make really make sense unless you
exactly, that's a really good point.
Relate, like, them to their teachings. I mean, I don't care about, like, you know, whatever Gurdjieff or Madame Blavatsky's peccadillos were. I think they only take on meaning when you relate them to. I mean, they're so kind of minor compared to what they're saying. And we've quoted this before, but he says, you know, that Gurdjieff had a fondness for threes. I mean, that's his discussion of the law of three. Like, it's beyond moronic. I mean, it's so stupid. It's insulting, you know.
You don't see substantive counter argument against mystical kind of viewpoints or propositions.
I was just flipping through some notes I have for the book. You know, I was going through various things from Carl Sagan. I was just sort of going through them randomly earlier. I wanted to see what I had taken notes of and had on my computer, and I came across these remarks from him from The Demon Haunted World and some of his other books, and he's talking about science and mysticism and the difference, and I mean, it's so striking, like, and he's talking about science and religion, so striking about how he doesn't really understand things. He says that, you know, what strikes him is that there's hardly anything in scripture which anticipates anything which modern science has revealed. That's complete nonsense. You know, like, I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, it's so bizarre that he says that, but see, he has such a limited understanding of these issues that's why he thinks that. I note that almost all of these people, too, that talk about about science and religion. They almost exclusively focus on Christianity, eh? Like
yeah.
mainly on European and North American Christianity in the last 600-700 years. Like there's absolutely no discussion. I've never read anybody discuss the Upanishads, for example, or the Vedas. And, you know, they'll quote them. Like, you know,
no.
Sagan's good at that. He'll quote stuff, but I don't think he's ever really studied them or read them, you know. They clearly don't recognize the profound nature of what's being said in them. I don't think any of these guys have read the Bhagavad Gita and really understand what it's about, you know. Or they wouldn't make all these dumb statements that they make. I don't think any of them can read the Bible and really understand, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of different interpretations and levels of explanation of the Bible, but I would say that an esoteric perspective is like night and day to a fundamentalist perspective on the Bible, and that's what's wrong. Again, they're attacking fundamentalism, which I agree with them. I mean, it's nonsense,
in my opinion.
That is such a limited understanding of what it means to be religious or what it means to believe in spirit or the soul or God.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole other... I mean, there's so many different. I mean, it goes back to your question about the gaps. I mean, or your comment on the gaps. It's because they subscribe to this mistaken understanding of consciousness, is that consciousness is just something which is produced by the material processes in the brain. It's because of that they don't have a different framework in which to interpret things, and they don't understand that all of this is about consciousness, and that a mystical and esoteric perspective on consciousness changes the meaning of everything.
Yeah. And then to compound that issue, you have all the evidences for psychical phenomena,
yeah.
out of body experiences, travels down a tunnel into a realm of light, or encountering dead relatives in other realms or dimensions. All these kinds of phenomena, of which, of course, there's like hundreds of thousands and millions of accounts of these types of experiences, which are inexplicable within the mainstream of science, and which scientists just kind of, with a hop, a skip, and a jump, they just dismiss them all and say there's no evidence for the paranormal. But really, there's all kinds of good evidences of all kinds. There's good evidences for ghosts. Like, very serious investigators have gone out and studied ghostly phenomena and provided evidences and stories that are intelligible and so on, you know, and repeated witnesses and all kinds of evidences for all kinds of these phenomena. And so that there's another gap in the mainstream of modern science. They can't explain this wealth of everything from near-death experiences to reincarnation memories. None of these things are explicable. They can't explain, you know, how does, I like that example used by Laszlo about an idiot savant who can calculate triple powers of numbers as fast as a calculator.
Yeah.
You know, and he can, like, has all these, like, phenomenal kind of arithmetic skills, and yet he's kind of hasn't been educated. He hasn't been taught how to do this. He can repeat the decimal places of pi to, like, 22,000 places. Like, this is just unbelievable. Like, how is that conceivable? And the only way, in a way, that is conceivable is that somehow there's information fields present within space that this fellow can somehow tap into. Because,
or the people that John Lorber cites in his article about people who basically don't have any brains, who have a very, 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 very thin layer of cortex and are basically hydrocephalic, and they don't actually have hardly any cortex, and yet they'll have normal to superior IQs in many instances. Some of them are profoundly retarded, but others are geniuses or completely normal and functional and have, you know, have the brains that work fine, even though they don't really have brains. But I mean, I think that literature too is amazing. I was thinking, you know, years and years ago, about 30 years ago, meant. It was 30 years ago. I was laughing. You said earlier, I've been studying this stuff for 20-some years. Actually 30-some years. It's when you get to be our age, you should always add 10 years to whatever you have, whatever happened, because it's always another 10 years before. But I remember about 30 years ago, you came to my place in Ottawa, and we were sitting around the table, and you said to me at one point, you know, I just think if I really knew that consciousness could exist apart from the body, it would change everything. And at the time, it was funny because I remember thinking, well, Uspensky says that, and I knew you were kind of like, you know, citing him and in a way and you know, referring to that. But I mean, that's a major question having to do with consciousness, because if that is true, that consciousness can exist apart from the body, then it isn't produced in the brain
the brain instead was a mechanism through which it functions in the material world.
Yeah, and it's the instrument. It's necessary but not sufficient for consciousness. You need a brain, but the really interesting thing is, I think of all the areas, to me, the area that's most convincing to me, that's most profound in its implications for our understanding of consciousness in terms of anomalous phenomena, is the near-death experience. And I think it's been the area that, even in the time that we've been studying things, it was just sort of getting going. I think Raymond Moody published his book Life After Life about 1975, 76, around that, maybe a little bit earlier. And in the intervening, 35 years, you know, essentially there's been all these people, a very, very interesting group of researchers, many of whom, like Moody, started out as skeptics, have all come to the same conclusion, that have written these books and have done these exhaustive studies, which I think, like, if you look at that evidence, I just don't see how you, unless you are just so blind and stubborn and unwilling to allow for an alternative explanation, I don't see how you can argue that this is not, you know, convincing evidence that consciousness can exist apart from the body. And then above and beyond that, what's so fascinating about this experience is how it's entirely, entirely congruent and consistent with what mystics have been saying for thousands of years about the nature of these higher dimensions, and about life and light and intelligent beings and beings of light, and it's
multi dimensions,
and then, like, on top of all that, like, you have, like, within your own work, what you've derived from Blavatsky, you have this perfectly compatible scheme, is like where things come within, without, and then resolve back within, like the dynamics in which you explain the arising and the termination of consciousness in the human body is entirely consistent with what someone would experience when they had a near-death experience, and what they would report after coming back. And we don't really know what it is to die, but now we actually have a pretty good idea. And oddly enough, it isn't interesting that it's like, it's the advancement in cardiac technology, which is resuscitation technology, which has provided us with this great, great insight. It's not brain surgery or anything. It's heart technology.
Yeah. Yeah, because death occurs when the heart stops, and that's when the soul is kind of separates from the body in these people.
More than anything, I find that area of literature, I think, that more compelling than any of the paranormal research. And that's not to denigrate or to dismiss the importance of that, but I just find it so convincing and so overwhelmingly real and not explicable in any other way. I would say that's a body of scientific evidence, which, when I referred to earlier, I said you could argue against the materialist position on a strictly scientific basis. I would say that's a major unexplained phenomena which completely undermines the materialist position and completely undermines the idea that consciousness is somehow produced by the brain. It isn't.
Okay, so, well, I'm that it would be really interesting, a book called The God of the Gaps, and go through all these major areas in which there's like
Yeah.
Stephen Hawking's ready to say, oh, we don't need God anymore because in modern physics we've got a new model of gravity. And
yeah.
Next week we'll go into that, because the new model of gravity, like why Stephen Hawking is saying we don't need God anymore, is likely based on the new development of the holographic paradigm, where you have black holes in alternate higher dimensional space, and that these serve as a kind of foundation for physical phenomena.
Yeah.
But this whole model that he's actually created is all consistent with Blavatsky. And,
yeah.
and so we've both got to get that book, and we'll have to do a review. Like, it's very interesting that my book's coming out at the same time as his is.
Yeah,
Stephen Hawking's at Perimeter Institute this year, eh?
Oh, yeah, right. Eh? Is that,
yeah,
in
Kitchener-Waterloo, Ontario.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah,
you know,
I want to send him a copy
yeah.
of this book of mine when it's ready.
You know that, yeah, it is the development in gravity. That's exactly what he does refer to when he said that there's no God. That was
yeah.
what he was talking about. Did you actually see the item? Like, did you actually read anything on the internet or in the paper or anything that about the
No, but.
But that is exactly what he said. He's talking about gravity. It was the theories of gravity that he was referring to that
yeah.
in his book. So you're right.
Well, see, that's that section of my book on Blavatsky that's very difficult is this
yeah.
modern understanding of black hole physics.
Yeah.
And the new concept of gravity. See, what they found is that string theory and M theory in higher dimensional space, or in what they call anti-de Sitter space,
right,
is rendered mathematically equivalent to material energetic processes within regular space-time. So there's an equivalency of these things occurring in hyperspace is rendered equivalent to all these material processes. What's so astounding about that, I mean, we'll develop this over the next weeks as we go into Blavatsky's ideas about the Leia centers and holes dug in space and how black holes being computers, that mini processors, like a black hole is described as the ultimate computer processor, central intelligence entity. So the new ideas in physics, with Hawking, it's this new model of holographic physics which postulates this anti-de Sitter space-time. But it all finds a parallel in Blavatsky is describing these monadic elements existing in seven-dimensional hyperspace. So their model is in the new holographic model. In string theory and M theory, they've always been able to incorporate gravity. Gravity is inherent to string theory. Whereas in particle theory, they've never been able to account for gravity. So that's why this new holographic model, you have this higher dimensional realm, and it produces gravity, and it's rendered mathematically equivalent to the material processes occurring within different dimensions. Anyway, we'll try to develop it over the next weeks and months. Isn't that copy, Jim, of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine a nice-looking book, eh?
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, it is. I was looking at it earlier. It's very, very attractive. It's a very nice book, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a series of edits into the
yeah.
editor, and I hope to produce a new copy, hopefully within this and next week.
Is that
so hopefully
like,
Sorry?
Oh, I was just going to ask you about the illustration on the cover. Is that like a lightning bolt coming down from like? Is there a figure there? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's Michelangelo.
I turned it
sideways.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, okay. I thought it's like Michelangelo, right? Like, okay,
yeah.
And
that's his God.
Yeah.
That's from the Sistine Chapel. That
yeah.
image. And this image is so ironic that this image was actually from Stephen Hawking's book, The
yeah.
Universe in a Nutshell.
Oh,
and
yeah.
it was done by the physicist who designs the equipment for handicapped people, who developed equipment for Stephen Hawking.
Oh,
his
really?
Name is Neil Shearer. And, yeah, he did this, and this image, I got permission from Neil Shearer to use his image. And he was fascinated. At one point, I sent him a chapter from the book, and he's made me promise to send him copies when it's produced.
Yeah,
I had to get his permission to use that image. Yeah, I had correspondence with him.
So
that's really funny because, just that kind of connection. I mean, I do want to send a copy of this to Stephen Hawking. I might even need to, I'm going to try to get a copy of his new book as soon as possible.
Yeah.
I have to watch for it. I noticed we're coming down to time.
Well, we should last a little longer. That's nice.
yeah, we did. No problems for the last 40 minutes or so here. Yeah. So we'll be back in 2 weeks, and let's pick up on God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, and we'll tie it back into Stephen Hawking and these issues of God and science.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jim.
And, thanks, Jim. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank BBS Radio.
Thanks, God, you guys.
We'll overcome the problems you face and all this interference. And it's just so valuable to have a forum to try to present this type of material. Okay, thank you all, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.